Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We'll be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Joseph Matthews. Joe is a lecturer in sports therapy at Birmingham City University with an interest in sports nutrition and muscle physiology. His research focuses on rapid weight loss in combat sports athletes and the risk associated with making weight, with the aim to help drive change to protect the health and well-being of athletes. Joe is also completing his PhD at Nottingham Trent University, where he's investigating the biological roles of carnosine and beta-alanine in skeletal muscle. Joe and I have some great organic discussion in this episode about why certain problems exist in combat sports and why research is important in solving them to make it safer for everyone who enjoys them. This is a really good episode with some powerful, down-to-earth messages that coaches, athletes, managers, practitioners, scientists, and fans should all take on board. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So in Season 4, we are kind of crisscrossing. We're doing half our season with gut health and then the other half with world-renowned sports scientist and performance nutritionist. Now today, we're joined by another English guest. We've got Joseph Matthews. Joe, thanks for coming on board, mate.
Pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Mate, are you based in England? You are based in England, right?
Yeah, based in England and in Birmingham, work and live out of Birmingham, but originally from the South Coast, so Portsmouth, a bit sunnier down there.
I always find when I speak to people from Birmingham, I don't know if it's a Brummy thing, but they always kind of like pull back before they tell you they're from Birmingham. I don't know why. Like, I've been there. I don't mind it. I think it's a nice place, but maybe the reputation's not there when you're in England.
I think it's better than its reputation. There's some nice areas. There's a hell of a lot going on here. It's a good place to be involved for research and practice. There's good gyms and those sorts of things. So yeah, it's a good spot to be.
Yeah, I absolutely love Birmingham. I couldn't recommend it higher. But let's get straight into it, Joe. And I like to ask this question to everyone that works in the field, because I guess nowadays it's a bit more accepted. But I know a few years ago when I used to tell people, oh, I work in combat sports, you'd get a few raised eyebrows and kind of funny looks, but you know, it's pretty well accepted now. But what made you get into it originally? Why did you have this interest and what made you pursue your research in the area?
So I guess originally I was a fan. So a big fan of boxing growing up. So as a teenager, I was watching boxing when you had like Ricky Hatton, Nassim Hamed, Joe Calzaghe as the British fighters. Once I started studying nutrition, sports nutrition, I wanted to get involved with specifically boxers, but combat sports in general. So I started working with a university boxing team. So it was amateur boxing, very different to some of the professional sports. They're fighting a lot more frequently, but I just walked into the gym and said, here's what I do. I've got an interest in the sport. Do any of your amateur boxers need a little bit of support? And they said, yes. So that kind of a sequence of events and a little bit of luck, I managed to start working with those guys, and that was really good. And then after I'd been working with them quite a short period, maybe just a few weeks, a month or so, the gym also had professional MMA fighters and some amateur MMA guys as well, and they saw the work I was doing with the boxers and again very gracious and gave me the opportunity and allowed me to work with some of their pro guys. So went kind of as a fan of boxing, really, to start working with the boxers. And then through it's a bit of opportunity, a bit of luck, but also the need for those guys to have a bit of support. A few doors opened there and I kind of went with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk all about your research, Joe. But before we get in there, I think this is probably a cool and unique perspective you could probably give us, because especially with amateur boxers, I'm assuming that you were doing the either same-day weigh-ins or multiple-day weigh-in format with them, which is quite different for the MMA setup. Before we get into talking about all the great research that you've done and your work with Peter Allen and everything, let's spend a bit of time talking about that. How did you find, or how do you go about working with, say, boxers where you've got that same day or multiple day weigh-in? And then how does that compare to the MMA guys with the longer weigh-in period?
Oh, geez, yeah. So kind of a world apart when you're comparing the two sports. With the boxers, was predominantly same day morning weigh-in with most of the events we're involved with. But the different challenge is that they need to be on weight or close to weight pretty much all season round, because competitions are sort of weekly or fortnightly. So you don't have the big dips and the increases and the decreases in body mass that you have with some of the pro guys in MMA. So the focus there is a lot different. There's not really a lot of rapid weight loss or acute weight loss techniques or dehydration. It's mainly just about having a diet that they're able to stick to and that is able to keep them relatively lean and maintain performance kind of throughout the season, which is the majority of the year, taking a couple of months off. Whereas with the pro MMA guys, as you're more than aware, is you see the big increases and decreases. So if they're competing two or three times a year, we're going to have the big spikes in body mass in between and the big drops. So although they both come under the umbrella of combat sport, they can't be approached in the same way. So it's just far, far too different. And the challenges are completely different in each sport as well, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, do you have any recommendations? Let's stick to the boxes and stick to the same day weigh-ins in terms of percentages, say, outside of fight camp, keeping in mind that they are doing this all year round and the season is quite frequent. What percentages do you recommend that, say, they're walking around in between the weekly competitions or fortnightly competitions, whatever it is, and what are you taking them down, say, the fight week or the week before? Do you have a certain cutoff point that you like them to be at then?
Yeah, so again, this probably depends on the frequency of competition is the main variable. But if you're competing weekly or fortnightly, then you have to be within sort of 2% of your fight weight, because you just can't afford those big drops, and there's not the time to restore it, and you don't have the luxury of having a period to reduce body weight with the previous fight being so close to it. So within a couple of percent, I mean, some of the guys stay on weight. I guess in amateur boxing, there's more of an advantage to being lighter on your own feet and being able to move around your opponent, as opposed to a benefit of leaning your mass on them, like you have some more in some of the grappling sports. So I think there are fewer advantages of competing heavy in amateur boxing compared to some of the other sports. I think there's less of a drive there to tolerate some of the big weight reductions and weight increases. So yeah, as close to the weight as possible, 2% is 3% maximum would be ideal.
Say, Joe, someone was walking around, they were staying pretty strict and they were saying staying 2 to 3% outside of that competition weight. What type of things are you getting them to do in the days leading up to the weigh-in and the competition, just to move that little bit of weight but that they have to get to weigh in?
Yeah, so very gentle, and be a little bit of a sort of an energy intake taper in the days before the competition, and just cycle carbohydrates are a little bit higher post in the phase just after a fight, and reduce those a little bit more in the few days before a fight. And then as long as you've got a little bit of time between the weigh-in, just have a high carbohydrate meal, that should restore most of the reduction. But yeah, very, very gentle processes. And I think once you get to know the fighters, you can gradually tinker this and you can get those little waves just up and down, and it's quite safe and quite manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's great. Well, Joe, let's start talking about your research. So you obviously had quite a bit of practical on the ground experience before you got into the research. Something that we've never really dived in deep with any of the guests, and I've got a lot of researchers on, but can we talk about what the research process kind of looks like when you're trying to, you know, get, even when you're coming up with what you want to research and then trying to get participants? And can you just talk us through what is the research process like?
Yeah, sure. So there's definitely no single approach or no best approach. You have to do what fits the sport, the circumstances, and then who you have available as well, be that the coaches on board or the athletes at your disposal. For myself, the process was arriving in boxing, there being a handful of a few pockets of research to help me start. But when I moved across to mixed martial arts, there was really nothing. So You do what you're told to do as a student or as a researcher. You go to some of the databases, you start looking for articles, you see, well, what has been documented on this group of athletes before, what are the recommendations? And you start to find that all of that falls down quite quickly because there's just nothing published in mixed martial arts. So you can then draw in the strands that you have from other combat sports and maybe some general sort of physique sports, but they are never going to answer the question that you need to answer for MMA. So my personal research process was, well, we need to start by just gathering some data. And the thing I didn't know is how much do these athletes change their body weight by across the competition week period, which seems like one of the most basic questions you can ask, but that information didn't exist. So I had a hole there of just knowing what was normal and what was expected. And then the second part to that question is, well, how can we best reduce and then increase that body mass in order to maintain kind of performance or maximize performance? Research in general, I mean, recruitment of participants is always a huge challenge. And I think traditionally a lot of combat sports haven't been super keen on inviting researchers and scientists sort of into the gym. And partly is that they're, I think, worried about being told to do things differently. If they've got a good system, they might not want people coming in. But also it's just an unfamiliar face. I mean, you know, working in combat sports is very insular in a good way, and it's a strong community. And if you're going to ask the athletes to do something, whether that be fill out a questionnaire or maybe give a urine sample or something, you need to be part of that community yourself to have the right to do those things. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is building relationships with the communities in order to understand, not go in to say, well, here's some research I want to do, but also what questions do you as athletes and coaches need answered, and working together, the researcher knowing what gaps exist in the research, but then the practitioner and the coach and the athlete helping or getting you to help those gaps filled from their perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's such a great point. It is such an individualized sport, hey, but that team culture and that team environment within combat sports is really tight knit. And like you said, that is a huge challenge. Even when you come in board and you're quite well known and trying to get in there and change certain belief systems and demonstrate that, hey, this works, can be quite difficult. That's excellent. So let's segue into your first paper that you brought out in 2017, Joe. Can you tell us about that, the extreme weight cutting across the UK? What did you find there?
Yeah, so this was published 2017. The data collection started a couple of years before, as the process in science is generally quite slow. So we collected these data throughout the year in 2015. And at this point, I'd been working with fighters for around a year or so. But as I just said, there was no information of what mixed martial arts athletes would normally do around the competition week. So we did a really basic study, and that we just observed what they did and recorded as much as we could within sort of practical constraints. So really simple stuff. So the fight week, the guys did a weighed food diary and just weighed everything they ate, which a lot of fighters are doing out of habit anyway. So we just recorded the numbers and analyzed their diets. We tracked changes in body mass throughout that week, and we tracked changes in hydration through urine. So really basic stuff. And then we just reported that so if you've got your competition on the Saturday evening, you weigh in on the Friday morning, which is quite common. If we go back to the prior Sunday, how much weight is lost from that Sunday to the weigh-in, and then how much is restored from the weigh-in to competition. And that's all we aimed to do, was just report what was normally happening among the fighters. So we didn't intervene. We had hoped to get around sort of 15 fighters initially, and then coming back to what some of the problems are, is we ended up with only 7 in the study in the end, because injuries and fighters pull out. And so it took a whole year to get information on just 7 fighters, which is part of the challenge, coming back to the research question. And so that was the general setup of the study. And there hasn't, even now, there hasn't actually been anything that, this is only a small sample, so we can't generalize too much about how this study refers to other fighters, but there hasn't really been many studies that have tracked the weight loss in that final week. A lot of it still to this day relies on self-report and questionnaires, which could be biased or might not be an accurate representation. So we tried to do something that was a little bit different, and we were really lucky. You had good coaches and the athletes were really on board, and they allowed myself and my co-researcher quite close contact, if you like, in that period. It's a bit intimate for them.
Yeah, that's excellent. And what did you find with those changes, Joe? What did you find when, in terms of the food diary and the hydration, how did it look once you got to the end of that research?
So we start sort of this Sunday before the weigh-in, sort of 6 days out from competition as it would be. They're on, majority of them are on a kind of a normal mixed diet. Some of the fighters at that point were already on really low carb. And then throughout the week, and we see a gradual reduction in weight loss, and that the average and the average weight loss was around 8% in those, or just I think it was just under 8% in those 5 or 6 days. By the time we get to the point of the weigh-in, we took a urine measurement of hydration, and this is something that's consistent with other studies as well, is that the majority of all athletes were dehydrated, with 4 out of those 7 being severely dehydrated. So we know that it's quite aggressive dehydration methods taking place in order to hit the weight category limit. And then again, consistent with other stuff and probably what you'd expect, a couple of days before the weigh-in, super low carb, so almost no carbohydrates, and some of the fighters are on really low calorie diets as well, just a few hundred calories. And then in the period from the weigh-in to competition, in this study they had, I think they had 32 hours between the weigh-in and competition, and obviously super high calorie, super high carbohydrate, and they're able to put back on a lot of the lost mass in that final week. And the rapid weight gain across that 32 hour period was about 12%. So this was the first time that a study had shown that the weight gain from the way into competition was able to exceed the weight lost in the week before.
Did you use the same data set when you did your next paper that came out about the rapid weight loss and rapid weight gain? Was that some from the same population or another population?
So the 2018?
Yep.
Yeah, so that was kind of a different approach. So we were conscious that with that 2017 study, we only had a handful of athletes, and you can't answer too many questions if you only have a few people, data on a few people. So the second paper in 2018 was trying to answer that same question, but not collecting any original data. We just reviewed everything that had ever been published on that question. So any scientific study that had directly measured, so we didn't use questionnaire studies, any study that directly measured rapid weight loss in that final week, so in the competition week, and how much weight is restored between the weigh-in and competition, and we included any combat sport, so it wasn't just mixed martial arts. And we had, I think it was around 16 studies in that review, and in total there was about 4,500 participants within those studies, combination of male and female, but mostly male, as is one of the huge limitations here. We have little to no data on female fighters, which is a big problem. And one of the questions we're looking to answer is, well, we've recorded this amount of weight loss in the competition week in our small sample. What have other studies recorded? And we actually found that there's almost nothing published that's directly measured this. Again, a lot of it relies on questionnaires. So we had 7 people in our study where we recorded the weight loss. There is another MMA study that has, I think it's 5 or 6 people in. And there was another study in wrestlers, which had 50 or so people in. And that's it. So in terms of direct measurement of weight loss in the week preceding competition, we've got data for about 70 people in existence.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was the overall consensus? Did it follow the suit of your original paper in 2017, Joe? Or was that inconclusive because of the lack of participants?
The 2017 paper was included in the 2018 review. So it was one of those 16 studies that was in there. And all of the studies we included, the study that showed the biggest changes in weight loss and weight gain across that fight week was our own study in mixed martial arts athletes. And that was by quite some way. So I guess this is probably a good segue into the difference that we see in the research compared to the practice, because anybody who's in practice knows that a fighter losing 8 to 10% in the fight week is not anything out of the ordinary. But in the research, if you collect data on 100 fighters, you'll report the average value that they change. And some fighters don't don't dehydrate or manipulate their weight an awful lot. So it might come out, if you collect data on 100 fighters, you might see that fighters reduce their body mass in the fight week by 5%. But that average is not what we need to be focusing on. We need to focus on the individuals at the extreme ends, because they're probably the people who are putting themselves at the greatest risk, but they're obscured within the average values of the other fighters, which is a problem of the research and where it doesn't quite overlap with what we see in practice.
Yeah, that was the next question I was going to ask you, Joe, is why is that important that this is represented in the research? And I think this comes up quite a lot, and especially for myself when I'm in practice a lot, like you just said, those numbers that you said, like an 8% drop, is usually what I would say most practitioners are recommending as the safe limit for an MMA coming into that fight week. Even up to 12%, if you know what you're doing and you can do it effectively, you can very well get 12% off safely. I know the UFC, their red zone is when you're over that 10%. Why is it so important, Joe? We kind of touched on it then, that we're focusing on getting more data on that and focusing on, hey, we need to figure out how much these guys are actually losing and showing that in the research. Why is it important that we have that data?
Oh, that's a great question. I think before we can understand a problem, we have to document its prevalence. So the first question in the research timeline is, well, how much of this is happening? Or how, as you mentioned, 8% and UFC being 10%. The first question is, how common is this? Is it that this is one athlete per country per month? Or is this that it's a dozen athletes in every city every weekend? And then once we've got an idea of the scale of the problem, we can look at ways of, firstly, of, well, how much, what's the highest percentage that can be changed safely or can be reduced safely with minimal health risk? And then secondly, well, how do we get that information into the hands of people who need it? And the more prevalent the problem, the more widely you need to disseminate that information. So, and that doesn't have to be in kind of official scientific papers. And if anything, things like this on the podcast are perfect, because you've got some great practitioners and researchers who come on who explain ways in which it can be done safer. And that's going to go directly into the hands of the athletes and coaches who need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hear that all the time on the ground, right? And it's almost frustrating to hear it, because there's this thing where people constantly say, probably not so much nowadays because we have, you know, researchers like yourself that bring out really good studies in this area, but definitely a couple of years ago where people would make the statement, oh, there's just no research within weight cutting. There's no research. So it almost was an excuse to do this extreme weight cutting, like you said, because we didn't know the prevalence of it. We didn't know what the effect was. And now that we're kind of getting this data, we can see, you know, what is it doing metabolically? What is it doing potentially to these guys' performance? What is it doing in terms of rebound hyperphagia after? How is this affecting the post weigh-in? How is this affecting when they go into their next fight camp? What's their body composition look like? So it's really important that we get it.
I've talked here about kind of larger studies with big numbers, but actually I think some of the most impactful work that we can do in science that's going to help practice is some of the case studies that have been published. So case studies are when we follow a single athlete, you try and collect as much data on that person as possible and document it in full, and then you write that up and report it. And I would give the guys at Liverpool John Moores University a shout out here in England. A really nice case study where they collected blood samples frequently throughout the fight camp and then also in the final week. And you're never going to get anything that invasive in a large group of people. And I think circling back to the point I just made when I said about we report average values in science. Well, if a fighter is unlikely to read a scientific paper, and if they do, they might say, well, I'm not an average, I'm an individual fighter. So case studies can show some of the more extreme practices. A, just to document them to see what changes. So in that case study in the male, it looked at some of the changes in blood biochemistry that occurred during the dehydration and in the rehydration phase. So we can understand some of the risks there. And in that particular case study, I think the dehydration was around 10%, and some of the blood markers changed to show that they'd actually suffered acute kidney injury. So we know that there's some substantial health problems there. But also it then is a bit more relatable to the person in the gym who might well be undergoing a similar amount of weight loss themselves. And I think sometimes in the research we do, and myself, I'm not immune to this, is I looked at one of the conclusions I'd actually made in my own paper, and it was that rule changes are needed that make rapid weight loss impractical. And those rule changes might help to change behavior in the sport, and that might help protect the health, safety, and well-being of competitors. But this exact same sentence was made 90 years ago in 1930 about wrestling. So by making these statements, we're probably not moving the field forward an awful lot. When we look back and we see that not an awful lot has changed, but what we can do, I think, that's a bit more impactful is to show fighters the way to do it in a more safe manner. And that's where I think the case studies are quite effective.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that that's case study that you're talking to, that Andy Casper and his team did, was absolutely phenomenal. I use this. Whenever I do a seminar tour, I always bring up this case study and I go through the points. I do it and you get quite a response from the crowd. I want to go through the numbers. I've got these in front of me now, Joe, and I want you as a scientist, as a researcher, to tell me what your reaction is when you hear these numbers, just so the guy's listening, because as you said, this isn't a particularly uncommon amount of weight for people to cut during that final week. So I want you as an educated scientist to tell me what your thoughts are about these numbers. So this person lost in total 14.5 kilograms, which was 18.1%. So they did 9.6 kilograms weight loss in the final 7 days and 7.3 kilograms, 9.3% dehydration in the final 24 hours. Within the final fight week, 14.5 kilos, and that final water cut was just under 10% dehydration. They had reduced RMR throughout the week. Their aerobic capacity obviously came down. Obviously, the markers you were talking about, the testosterone plummeted over the last 7 days, absolutely plummeted. Cortisol levels tripled during the extreme weight loss in the last week. There was plasma sodium went up to over 145, and it was clinically in the range of hypernatremia, and creatinine, which you alluded to, which is suggestive of acute kidney injury, went up past the threshold. So when you hear those numbers, what type of things go through your mind as an active researcher, as a scientist in this area?
I guess my main two thoughts are that, firstly, I should be shocked, but I'm not. Those numbers should be horrifying, but you've almost become normalized to it when you've been in the sport a while. So anyone outside the sport hearing those numbers will either think that they're A, not possible, or B, it's just absolute madness. Why would anybody do that? And then my second thought is those numbers you say are exactly well within the ranges that have led to the deaths of half a dozen fighters in the last couple of decades. So we've got a situation that's not uncommon or unique, but well within kind of fatal limits. And I find that quite difficult to process some days, particularly if we circle back. I guess the most famous instance in the sport was in wrestling in 1997. So I had three. And for anyone who doesn't know, in wrestling in 1997, collegiate wrestlers within the space of 3 to 4 weeks died as a result of making weight. So that was sort of extreme dehydration coupled with training in heated rooms. And unfortunately, they all lost their lives. And when we look at the amount of weight they were trying to reduce in the final 24 hours, it was in the final dehydration, just the final 24 hours, they'd already lost quite a bit before then. But it was sort of 7, 8, 9, 10, 11%. And the numbers you just said there for the case study, sort of 9%, it's bang in the middle of those ranges. So we've got fighters who are competing in a dangerous sport. We know that. But potentially the most dangerous aspect is the 2 days before it even occurs, which is quite frightening.
So Joe, I guess my second question to this is, why is it, do you think, it's become so normalized within the combat community? Why is it that if people hear those numbers, they just go, oh yeah, that's normal. Like, that's just what you've got to do. That's the fight before the fight. You've just got to do it to compete. Why do you think it's become so normalized?
Well, that's a really great question. I'm not sure there's a single answer for that. I think partly it's the culture of the sport, because things have always been done this way, so things will continue to be done this way. And partly people trying to push the boundaries of, can they drop one weight class lower, or can they just get that little bit more off their body to go to a lower category. I think if you see people around you doing it successfully, then it makes you think that there aren't the risks either overstated, or there aren't any risks if you regularly see people dropping sort of 10% and they always seem to be fine. I guess the big desire is to, if you're up against an opponent who you know is going to shift those kind of numbers, then it's quite daunting to think, well, if I don't do that myself, I'm going to be hugely disadvantaged against them when I get into competition. So there's an element of trying to avoid a disadvantage and kind of protect the safety of yourself. But the other side of that coin might be trying to actually gain an advantage. So if you're a wrestler or a grappler, and you want to be leaning your mass on your opponent, then you might want to try and bring yourself in as heavy as possible. So, you know, if you reduce the weight as much as you possibly can, then you can restore that to a greater extent after the weigh-in. But yeah, what do you think?
I think that it's personally, and this is going to be my next question to you, I was going to try and tease out. I think it's almost exactly the culture, but a lack of education almost on our behalf, because we have access to these numbers. I firmly believe that there is a bit too much of a gap. There's a knowledge gap between what we know as scientists and then what the coaches and the athletes and the managers and what those guys on the ground know. And I think 3 to 4 to 5 years ago, that was almost acceptable. Like you said, when you started this research and your data collection in 2015, you did your lit review and you went, oh crap, there's no research. We do that in 2020. I don't think that's a good enough excuse right now. So I think there needs to be more bridging of this gap, and there needs to be more education into the hands of the fighters themselves, into the coaches, into the managers. And I think, you know, platforms like the ACSM, where they're getting you to talk about your research, and then we can run podcasts like this, and, you know, people like Carl Langan Evans and, you know, James Morton can put out all their great research, and Mark Germain can put that information on Instagram for us to share around. I think that all contributes to closing that gap and making a really big impact in this area. And I think it all comes down to education. And I think that's why we all do this, right? That's where we want to do it. And like we constantly say, no one wants to pay you and me to go and grapple or punch each other in a ring. No one's going to pay good money for that. But we want to watch people do that, and we want to make sure that it's safe and better the sport by, you know, getting this information out there.
I would love to, as somebody who does research and tries to spread that education message, I would love to say that I think education can solve the problem, but I don't think it can. I think in wrestling, we've got some really good examples of, I think it's part of the solution. Don't get me wrong. I think absolutely education is part of the solution. But I think in wrestling, when after the deaths in 97, they brought in some rule changes to try and prevent the harmful rapid weight loss. And part of that was education program, but part of it was changes, so moving the weigh-in closer to competition, banning dehydration methods, some of the general stuff that you might expect. And they actually found, there's a really nice study where they looked at the rapid weight loss and rapid weight gain habits of wrestlers who were competing out of season in international freestyle wrestling. And out of season wasn't subject to the same rules and regulations. So these group of wrestlers, they had the same education, they had the same knowledge, and in season they were reducing their body weight by less than what wrestlers had done in the past, so the practices were healthier or appeared to be healthier. But when they competed out of season, the rapid weight loss went sky high again. So these guys had the education, they had the support from their college in the season, but when the rules were relaxed, they went back to old habits. So that makes me a little bit more pessimistic about education alone. But I think we absolutely have to show fighters how to do it in a more safe way. I think there do need to be some changes to the rules that make wanting to do it in a healthier way more valuable. And I think one of the other parts of the puzzle that's really difficult is to change behavior and create an environment where the fighters can can make weight in a healthier way, and they have the resources available to do that.
And I completely agree with what you just said, Joe. That's absolutely part of the problem. I want to get your thoughts on this because you do have this unique experience where you worked with the amateur boxers and you've gone crossover and you've done the research with the MMA guys and also work with them. And as we all know, MMA seemed to be the sport that does the most extreme weight cutting. What do you think? Why is it that, say, a sport in boxing and the amateur boxing, those guys, it's just, say, not as expected of them to cut so much weight compared to MMA? Do you have any thoughts on why that might be culturally or behaviorally?
Yeah, I guess you're absolutely right that MMA has the biggest problem. And I know from my own practice, I've worked with fighters who have competed in other combat sports in their past where they have stayed much closer to their fighting weight. But when they've transitioned to MMA, they've then begun to undergo larger weight cuts and larger rapid weight loss and rapid weight gain. I think part of the problem, I think, is the structure. So there's fewer weight classes in mixed martial arts compared to something like amateur boxing, which means you've got more or larger gaps in between the categories. So you might just by kind of circumstance, you might have to reduce your body weight by a larger amount from what your natural weight is to reach a certain weight class. I think some of it is the nature of the sport. As the sport in general is quite extreme, everything's quite extreme, and I think the biggest promoter of mixed martial arts is the UFC, and they have their weight, their weigh-ins are, and they're publicized, and you see fighters regularly missing weight, and it's almost a bit of an entertainment spectacle to some extent. And I know those things are getting a lot better now they've got the Performance Institute, and they're bringing a bit more science into the sport, which is fantastic. But historically, those kind of harsh weight cuts have not been demonized. They're almost celebrated to a certain extent if we circle back half a dozen years. So if you're in the sport and competing, you start to see that as the normal. You say, well, these are the guys at the top of the tree, and this is what they're putting their body through as part of the weigh-in. That's obviously what I need to do as well. And I think you see that less with other combat sports.
Would you almost say, Joe, that it's almost you've got to get there at the grassroots levels and kind of teach them while they're young and demonstrate and show that these practices can be done? We're not saying that, hey, you don't have to not do it, but there's probably a better way to do it. Do you have to get in at the grassroots maybe then and then make the change there?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and I'd probably go at both ends of the spectrum. So I think grassroots is super important to get people into good habits as soon as possible. But also the fighters who are having the most success, if you can get them on board and they can become the voice for how to do it properly, that's far more powerful than someone like myself standing in front of a group of fighters and saying, look, here's a better way to do it. If they've got a fighter who they look up to and is someone who's won stuff in the sport and that message comes from them, I mean, I can pack up my bags and have an early retirement because the hard work is done. So I think grassroots level is absolutely key, but also getting the people at the top of the tree to help to be on board as well, and them to become ambassadors for doing it in the right way.
Yeah, it almost kind of reminds me, I don't know about you, Joe, but back when we were at university in our undergrad doing, say, public health nutrition or something, and coming up with how you make change within a community or something, and going through, okay, you got to engage the key stakeholders. You've got to go in there and get right at the bottom, get these guys on board, and you need to have some education program and something, which is absolutely true. It's such a multifaceted problem. But I think, as you said, you would have noticed over the last 5 years in your research just how much of a contribution researchers like yourself and Carl and James have had in the sport.
Oh yeah, I liked, and some of the guys you've mentioned have done some great stuff, and it's been a good time to be involved in research in the sport, because 5-6 years ago there was nothing, whereas now we have some published case studies, people publishing blogs that are a lot more accessible and a lot more reader friendly to the audience that needs them. There's podcasts of describing what sort of amounts of body weight you can reduce safely and restore safely, and then how to do that with your diet and exercise. And none of this was available sort of 5 or 6 years ago, not in mixed martial arts. So I think it'd be good to revisit some of these questions and points in 5 years' time and see how much we've moved forward. Because to use a comparison, I think wrestling has moved forward, and they're certainly in a better position than they were a few decades ago, but they will still say that there's problems that they need to solve. So I don't think we'll solve all of these problems, and I don't think that a kind of rapid weight loss and rapid weight gain should be overtly banned. But I think we need to support athletes in doing it in the safest way possible.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And I think that's what kind of gets all of us out of bed every day, right? We do want to support these athletes. We want to support the coaches. We want to support the community and the cultures within the gym to just look after the athletes and make sure they're as healthy as possible. And I guess health is one aspect of it, one massive aspect. I think we do need to, in this podcast, talk about one aspect that you're quite the expert in, which is more related to performance, which is your research into beta-alanine. Now, this is a supplement that I'm quite a big fan of, so I'm really excited to hear you talk about. Can you tell us about, firstly, I want to talk to you about your 2019 paper on beta-alanine, but just give the listeners at home, what is beta-alanine and why is it useful in terms of performance?
Yeah, so this is, beta-alanine is a really common supplement, and it's in a lot of pre-workout kind of mixes as well. And if people don't know it by name, they probably know it by its response of how it makes them feel. So if you've ever had too many scoops of your pre-workout, and then you have like a tingling, we call it paresthesia, where you've got some sort of numbness or an itchy feeling on sort of your face and your arm. And that's probably the effect of the beta-alanine in the supplement. Beta-alanine by itself is not what enhances performance, but it is responsible for giving you those side effects. But the reason beta-alanine is particularly good is that it's a precursor for something called carnosine. Now, human beings, we have carnosine in our muscle in quite large amounts, but by supplementing with beta-alanine, we're able to increase the amount of carnosine in the muscles by anywhere between, if you supplement sort of high doses, you could increase that by 50% up to maybe even 200%, sort of threefold. So the capacity to increase carnosine in the muscle is quite high. And it's the increase in carnosine that can help improve exercise performance. And it probably does a few other roles in the muscle cell as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about what you found in your 2019 paper. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so this is one of the first parts of my PhD work, which is actually separate from combat sports. So I'm still involved in combat sport research, but beta-alanine and carnosine is a focus of my doctoral work. And that's with Professor Craig Sale at Nottingham Trent University, who's one of the best groups to do this type of work with. There's been quite a lot of reviews and studies on beta-alanine and the effects on performance, but there hadn't been in recent years a kind of a solid look at how it improves performance. So we just dived into this. Was a review again. We've got some data collected on some of these parts now. But this review just looked at, once we increase carnosine in the muscle, how is it that it changes the muscle function? So from an exercise performance perspective, but also from a health perspective as well. So we looked at some of the mechanistic work that had been done, and the mechanism that's probably most important for carnosine is that it works as what we call a pH buffer. So anyone listening will probably know, if you do a super intense exercise session or you're on the watt bike and you spin your legs as fast as you can, you'll start to get a burning sensation or that kind of heavy feel in your legs and arms. So we call that high intensity work, where it's stressing the anaerobic glycolysis system. And that feeling of kind of heaviness, or the feeling when you can't cycle your legs anymore, most people have felt it. Increasing carnosine is able to help reduce some of those effects, or it enables you to work for a few seconds more until the fatigue kicks in. So for high intensity intermittent performance, it seems to be quite beneficial.
Hey guys, quick interruption here, but well worth it. You guys know that I work with a lot of fighters at world-renowned City Kickboxing, and if you've ever been to CKB, you'll notice that almost all the fighters are wearing Engage fight wear. I'm talking everyone. They're all wearing Engage gloves, shinies, headgear, shirts, shorts, and even slides. When I say everyone, I'm talking guys like middleweight champ Israel Adesanya, featherweight champ Alexander Volkanovski, lightweight champ to be Dan Hangman Hooker, Kai Kara France, Brad Riddell, and Shane Young. They're all wearing Engage, and they're all wearing it because the gear is not like any other fight gear you would have used before. The gear is custom made with top quality material and is by far the most stylish gear you'll see on the mats. So you can see for yourself, Engage has sorted my listeners out with a 10% discount code. All you need to do is apply TFD10 on checkout so you can see why everyone is repping Engage. All right, back to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you kind of talk us through mechanistically and let's not hold back and let's go through quite the science of it if you don't mind. Mechanistically, how is that happening?
Yeah, so there's a few different mechanisms. The main one would be as a pH buffer. So when you're engaging in high intensity exercise, there's a decrease in muscle pH, or we'd call that an increase in acidity. So muscle pH will drop just by a couple of units. Now, one of the things that, or one of the proposed mechanisms of fatigue, is that the drop in pH kind of inhibits some of the contractile apparatus in the muscle. So you're not able to contract as forcefully or effectively. And it's just that there are a few competing hypotheses of what causes fatigue, and this is just one part of the puzzle. So by increasing carnosine in the muscle, it's when we have this drop in pH, what that means is there's an increase in free hydrogen ions in the muscle, and that's a byproduct of anaerobic metabolism. And carnosine is able to bind to these hydrogen ions, and by binding them, it can attenuate that drop in the pH. So that's part of the process. Carnosine is also able to help with a different part of, we think carnosine is able to help with a different part of muscle contraction, and that's when you send the signals to your muscle to contract, there's a release of calcium within the muscle, and then that calcium is then, as the muscle relaxes, that calcium is then taken back up into some organelles in the muscle that store it. And carnosine is also able to bind calcium. So when that calcium is released in the muscle, carnosine can bind it and potentially transport it around the muscle a little bit more efficiently. Now that's very difficult to show in humans, but there is some data that supports that as well, and that supplementing with beta-alanine for 4 weeks, 6 weeks is able to decrease the relaxation time of muscle, which is a positive thing. So the muscle is able to relax a little bit quicker after contraction. So they're two of the major roles that it plays. Something else we looked at in the review is its ability to bind kind of toxic what we call toxic lipid peroxidation products. So this would be more of a health angle. So carnosine is able to act as a buffer, as I said, in the first instance. It's able to transport calcium, as I said, in the second instance. But its third action is it's able to bind and essentially work as a similar to an antioxidant would. And it's able to mop up some of the toxic byproducts you might have in an unhealthy muscle. And some of my PhD work is looking at just that in type 2 diabetic muscle as well. So moving away from some of the exercise performance stuff to see if we have a type 2 diabetic muscle or a muscle that's insulin resistant, can increasing carnosine actually help with some of that?
Absolutely phenomenal. Hey, and I kind of get a same type of feel that when creatine came through, and initially it started in the sports nutrition realm, and then it came on to show that it had all this amazing health benefits, say for the elderly population or for just general health. Do you feel that's where the beta-alanine research will end up going?
Yeah, I think so. I think with both of creatine and beta-alanine, the good thing is that we already have these things within our muscles. So we already have creatine, so it's already doing the job. We already have carnosine, it's already doing the job. So part of the problem with sports supplements is where there's a new supplement, is does that ingredient actually get to where it needs to go? I think one of the things that is so much better for creatine and carnosine is that we know we can directly increase those stores in the muscle. So whatever it does normally, we can just add more of it. So the theory is that more is better, but we know that's often not the case. So I think the applications for beta-alanine will extend beyond exercise performance, but we're only just beginning to scratch the surface of that at the moment. So I'd hedge my opinions at this stage, and hopefully we'll have a few more answers there in a few years' time. For as far as combat sport athletes are concerned, I think beta-alanine is a good option. And it is always a risk reward of what's the benefit of taking this versus what are the potential negatives. And with something like creatine, you've got the negative of water retention that can be problematic if you're trying to make a weight category, which I think deters a lot of combat sport athletes from taking. And whereas you don't have those problems with beta-alanine. So it might improve high intensity exercise performance, but there's not really any negative trade-off other than some unpleasant side effects if you take too much in a single dose.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, all supplements are risk versus reward. And when you get to those high levels and you're talking about USADA and things like that, you need to really weigh those things up. And that's what I always like to say and promote about beta-alanine is like, yeah, if you can dose it properly and, you know, you don't mind a few ants crawling over your skin just for a little bit, then absolutely, it's so risk-free. What would be a recommended dosage you would recommend, Joe?
So dosages range. So the lower end is sort of 3.2 grams per day, and that would be split into four dosages of 0.8 of a gram or 800 milligrams. But you can go as high as 6.4 grams a day, which would be double that. But again, splitting into four doses throughout the day. So have it when you have your meals or just make a break in between them. So if you had 6.4 grams per day, then that would be dosages of 1.6 grams per dose when you split into four. And the reason we split those up is just, as you said, to avoid some of those crawling ants over your face and some of the side effects. And that paresthesia or those itching sensations that people feel are related to the rise in beta-alanine in the plasma. So once it's absorbed. So by spreading out those dosages, you can minimize some of those, both the severity and the occurrence of them. And then if we say that it's going to be the higher dose, the 6.4 grams per day, then if you take that for a month, and beta-alanine is something where you will need to take it over a period of time. There's no acute effect on performance. But if you take it daily for 4 weeks, then you can probably increase the stores in the muscle by about 2/3. And if you take it for a prolonged period of time, and so the longest study that's been done is 24 weeks, and that's by Brian Saunders and his group in Sao Paulo. And what they found is 24 weeks of supplementation at that high dose, 6.4 grams per day, they had a really big variation in individual responses in the muscle. Some people in 24 weeks only got an increase of about 2/3, whereas other people, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, went up to 3 times the amount they had in the muscle at baseline. Now the hypothesis goes, well, the more you have, the greater the performance effect should be, but we don't know if that is the case. It might be that once you've reached a certain amount, all of the performance benefits kind of cap off there.
Yeah, absolutely. But like you said, the risk that with you taking it is quite literally just the paresthesia and the bit of the tingling, which you can negate by spreading out your dosage.
Yeah, and I do know, as I'm fortunate to be studying in Nottingham Trent University under Craig Sale, who did the initial work with Professor Roger Harris on beta-alanine sort of around sort of 16, 17 years ago. Now, I do know that if you go above from the stuff they did in their lab at the time, if you do go above that 6.4 grams per day, or if you put the individual dosages too high, the side effects become unpleasant to the point where they're almost unbearable. And there's some good stories of people being on the floor in the lab and struggling quite a bit, I think. So although those side effects don't, as to the best of our knowledge, those side effects have no other detrimental effects. It's just unpleasant. You really do need to be careful with the dosage. And again, anyone who's gone really heavy on their pre-workout probably knows this already.
Yeah, so absolutely. Just control the dosage. Now, Joe, that's absolutely fantastic. I'm being very mindful of time here. That was a great episode. I think we went through some really important points there. I think that initial discussion was great. I feel like athletes, coaches, managers, other researchers, practitioners will all get something out of that. I think that's absolutely fantastic to talk about beta-alanine and the proposed benefits for that with combat athletes. Do you have any final remarks that you want to go through, Joe? Say whether it's two athletes to coaches, it's about your research, it's about beta-alanine, anything you'd like to leave in the minds of the athletes, coaches, other practitioners, other scientists, other researchers listening?
Just to everyone in the combat sport community, really, we've all got a part to play. And I'm always incredibly thankful to the athletes who give their time and allow us to come in and take measurements and disrupt or partially disrupt what needs to be a very focused time for them, and the coaches as well. So I'm very thankful to athletes and coaches who allow us in, but I think we all have a part to play in moving the field forward and making it safer. So practitioners.
Well, Joe, I appreciate you taking the time, man. I know you're really busy. But mate, I'm sure I'll get you on again and we'll have another chat soon. So thanks so much, mate.
Perspective and what they need, as opposed to working in silos. And I think in the last 5 years, that's happened at a fantastic rate. And I hope that continues for the years ahead.
Absolutely. I don't think there's a better statement to finish on than that. Lastly, if people listen to this and they go, wow, I need to get into contact with Joe. I need to follow him on social media. I need to know his email. What's the best way for guys to get in contact with you?
Best way is probably most active on Twitter, if anyone is still using that apart from me. And that's a quiet platform these days. But I'm Joe John Matthews on Twitter. Same again on Instagram, Joe John Matthews. And my email address, more than happy for people to get in contact with questions, is joseph.matthews@bcu.ac.uk.
Awesome. Well, Joe, I appreciate you taking the time, mate. I know you're really busy, but mate, I'm sure I'll get you on again and we'll have another chat soon. So thanks so much, mate.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, mate.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. What a great discussion with an experienced researcher and practitioner in the combat sports world. The points Joe made are extremely important, and if we are to move forward as a community, practitioners, researchers, coaches, and athletes all have to work together to make it happen. I also can't recommend more that you read up on his research about beta-alanine, as it is one of the supplements with huge potential in this space. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.